All right, so we have Parshas Kisete, page 1046. Yeah. It's a hard parsha to give a overview because there's lots and lots of mitzvahs. Just a bit of an overview. The parsha begins with the captured woman, the mitzvah of the woman that was captured during war, and the soldier wants to marry her, and the whole process of how that takes place. Here we're. The mitzvah of the two firstborns, someone has two wives and two firstborns, one he likes, one he doesn't like, and the whole laws of inheritance, the rebellious son. And then we have a range of different mitzvahs. Now, just to give you an idea, you can't go through all of them because there's 27 positive mitzvahs in the Torah and 47 negative commandments in the Torah, in this parsha. It's one of the parshas that have the most lists of mitzvahs in them. So I'm not going to go through, but just, it's mitzvahs to do a lot with relationships, adultery, these kind of things. It's got to do with loans, investments, things like that. Learning, I'm just giving you a couple. Kilayim, not to wear wool and linen, not together, not to work with two different animals. Building a fence around the roof so that people shouldn't fall. Men and women not wearing each other's clothing. Learning, returning lost property. Honest weights, measures, these kind of things. Just as a couple of examples. We also have the mitzvah of Yibum. Yibum is a levirate marriage. If someone dies and has a brother, someone dies childless and has a brother, the brother has an obligation to marry his wife. If not, there's a chalitza. And so on. And finally, in the Torah, we have the mitzvah of remembering Amalek, which is the portion we read on the Shabbos before Purim. But it comes from this week's parasha, the mitzvah to remember the war against Amalek and to wipe out Amalek and to always remember what Amalek did to the Jewish people when they came out of Egypt. Okay. But what I want to do is two things today. And it's all centered on one concept. As we've mentioned many times, the Shalosh says that the parsha of the week is always connected with the times that we're in. We're right now in the month of Elul. The month of Elul is the time of Cheshbon, the time of Tshuva. Tshuva, we know, is of course a powerful gift. It's a gift that really reaches the very foundation and relationship between a Jew and God. Because that's what Tshuva is. Tshuva is able to repair the relationship, going down to the very depth of the relationship, as we'll soon see. So what I want to do is share with you from the parsha, as a parsha concept, but from the parsha, I want to go through two concepts, two different concepts from the parsha that demonstrate the power and the tremendous impact of the concept of tshuva. One of these concepts, I think I shared with you many years ago, but it was a while ago, so I think we can do it again. And one of them, and it comes from a book called the Emunas Itecha. Emunas Itecha is a collection of talks given by a big Rav who's still alive. His name is Rabbi Wolfson. He has a very big following in Borough Park. And he's got very, very creative ideas, very, very powerful ideas. Written in his sefer called Emunas Itecha, which is the one concept I'm going to share with you. And the other is, from a different part of the parasha, an amazing idea got to do, coming out and connected to the concept of tshuva, coming from one of the sichas, one of the essays of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So two different concepts, and we're going to go through each one. The first one relates to the rebellious son. So we have this mitzvah in the Torah called the rebellious son. Let's have a look at page 1046 at the bottom. Let's learn it inside. So it's a famous mitzvah called the mitzvah of the rebellious son. The Torah says the following. It's all the way at the bottom, verse 18. Take a new one. Verse 1046. Are you okay? Yeah. So the Torah says, ki yila ish, if a man will have, ben soirer umoire, a wayward and rebellious son. Einenu shamea, he does not listen, b'kol aviv v'kol imay, to the voice of his mother or to the voice of his father. Yisroi say, they punish him, v'lo yishma aleim, and he does not listen to them. B'sofsu boi aviv v'imay, I'm just reading it the way it says it, then we'll understand what this is. B'sofsu boi aviv v'imay, the his mother and father will grab him. Will take him to the elders of his city. To the gate of his place. They take him to the Beis Din. They will say to the elders of his city, this our son, he's a wayward and rebellious son. And then Shamer Bakalenu, who does not listen to our voices. Zoilel the Soive, he's gluttonous. He's been eating huge amounts of food and drinking huge amounts of wine. So, what does the Torah says? Urugamu kol ancha ira ba'avonim, let all the people of the city stone him with stones and let him die. Vameis. Ubi'atara mikibecha, and eradicate evil from your midst. Chol Yisrael yishmu uvira, and all the entire Jewish nation will hear and take heed. That's what it says. Now, what does all this mean? So, first of all, we have to understand what this mitzvah is referring to, and then we have to understand if the mitzvah was ever applied or can it be applied. First of all, using Torah Shabbat Peh, the oral Torah in Sanhedrin, we're talking about a very, very extreme case. First of all, we're talking about a child. The whole mitzvah only applies to a child at a very particular age. It's only within a space of 3 months. If the child is 13, for the next 3 months. Otherwise, the whole mitzvah doesn't apply. That's number one. Number two, apparently the kind of basic thread of what happened was as follows. This child was a very rebellious child, and he stole money in order to party, to indulge, and he's eaten a certain amount of meat. It's a huge amount of meat and a huge amount of wine from stolen money. And he's just on a collision course. He's on a bad path, right?
This would relate today to us.
Yeah, I was thinking of us, actually. Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Okay, well, since the Torah's approach to this, I'm going to show you an amazing, amazing idea. And then they take him to Beis Din, and they try and punish him with lashes, but it doesn't work, and he keeps stealing, and he keeps doing it. So the Torah says, eventually, you know what you should do? You should put him to death. Why? Why? So the Gemara says, that Ben Soira Ramore Nerag Al Shem Soifa, the Ben Soira Ramore is killed because of his end. What's going to happen if you don't kill him? So he's going to keep stealing. He's going to run out of methods to steal. He's going to keep attacking people and mugging them. Eventually, he's going to end up killing. He's going to end up murdering. And murder is a capital offense. So therefore, you know what? Kill him now to save the whole thing. That's what the Torah seems to be saying. The problem is that it can never actually be applied because in Torah Shabbat Peh we learn the halachas are so complicated, the conditions in order to actually have a child reach the status of Ben Soira Ramore is so complicated, like apparently the father and the mother have to be exactly the same height, we learn that from Sukkim, and have to speak in one voice, and their voice has to be a similar tone. It's almost an impossible thing to happen. Which obviously begs the question, if it's possible to happen, so why is it there, and what's it for? So let's take the study. Let's have a look at the Gemara. It's on your handout. The first paragraph. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara says the following. Lehoya v'le asi liyos. The Gemara says, this mitzvah of Ben Soira Ramore, with its punishment, never happened, and never will happen. It's an impossibility. It's a statistical impossibility for this to happen. I mean, it's not impossible to have a son that's naughty, but it's a statistical possibility for the Torah, for this halacha to play out the way the Torah wants it to play out. Says the Gemara, v'lomo nichtav. So why is it written if that's the case? Says the Gemara, droish v'kabel schar. It was written so you should learn it and get reward for learning it. That's all. It's a piece of Torah. That's what the Gemara says. It's an extra piece of Torah study, so we should have another mitzvah to study, to analyze, to learn, to understand. And we should get the mitzvah of, apparently what the Gemara is saying, get the mitzvah of Torah study. That's one opinion in the Gemara. So one opinion in the Gemara is that it never happened, never will happen, it's impossible. And it's only reason why it's written is to learn it and get reward. Continues the Gemara, Omar Rabbi Yonasan said, Ani Re'isiv, I saw one. I saw Ben Soira Ramore for a case. The Yashafti al Kivra, and I sat on his grave. In other words, what are you telling me didn't happen? Of course it happened. I was at the grave of Ben Soira Ramore. Okay, that's the Gemara. So the questions on this Gemara are many. First of all, what does it mean it never happened, never will happen? And If so, why is it written just to get reward? I mean, it's not like we're desperate for extra topics in Torah to study. As if this wouldn't be in the Torah, so okay, there'd be a chunk of the Gemara Sanhedrin that wouldn't exist. One chapter, one paragraph of the Torah. But I mean, it's not like we would be bored, right? Torah is endless, it's very deep, we've got plenty to learn. Why would Hashem have to slap on another halacha in the Torah just for us to get extra Torah study? As if the curriculum is poor, we need extra time. it's endless. What we have is endless. We don't need an extra piece necessarily. Right? Number one. Number two, how can you have an argument like this? If Rabbi Yonason comes along and he says that I saw a Ben Sora Remora case play out, and I actually would as his grave, and I was implying that it went all the way to the end and the guy was killed and he is buried, and I sat on his grave. If that's the case, what is he, a liar? So how could there be a dissenting opinion? You can have, first of all, it's very difficult anyway. You know, you have different kinds of disputes in the Torah, right? In the Gemara, we have many, many hundreds of disputes. Most of them are halachic disputes. So the halacha is, you analyze a portion of the Torah differently. Beis Shammai comes to the conclusion that it's forbidden. Beis Hillel comes to the conclusion that it's permitted. Fine, it's two different viewpoints. We understand they're both right. How do we do it? There's a system of how you work out what the halacha is. But they're both legitimate Torah approaches as long as they follow the system, right? It's all fine. But it's very difficult to have a machlokes in metzias, a machlokes in what happened. It either happened or didn't happen. I mean, how can you, what do you mean? Particularly if one of the sides of the argument says, I saw it. I'm not arguing about a historic thing that happened 100 years ago. I saw Ben Sora Mora play out. So if Rabbi Yonason says, I saw it and I sat on his grave, how can the first opinion say, no? Never happened, never will happen. He says it did happen, he saw it. Question clear? I mean, it's, right? How can they argue? He says he saw it, he saw it. Second question. Third question is, what exactly was Rabbi Yonason doing sitting on a grave of a Ben Sora Remora? He had nowhere else to rest. What kind of expression is that? If you would say, I saw a Ben Sora Remora and I witnessed the killing in Beis Din. I was there, you know, that day that they killed him, executed him. Then I understand. But no, I saw Ben Sora Remora and I sat on his grave. What on earth does that mean? What kind of expression is that? Okay, questions clear? So the Emunah Sitacha at Rabbi Wolfson gives the most amazing pshat. He says like this. Let's analyze what is a Ben Sora Remora. Ben Sora Remora is a child who's off the track. And the theme of Ben Sora Remora is that it's a child, a son that has gone off the rails to the point where it appears that he's reached a point of no return. Right? So much so that there's a svara, there's a logic, there's a place in rational thinking to say, let's kill him now to prevent two people getting killed. Right? That's the theme of Ben Sora Remora. So if we kill him now, we'll prevent him from murdering. That means if he murders, it'll be a capital punishment. He'll get killed anyway. Plus the victim will get killed. So kill him now because this is on a course where it appears there's a point of no return. Okay? That's the scenario. The scenario we're talking about is a 13-year-old, that's a child who has hit rock bottom. Rock bottom that there's absolutely no hope. So what does the Torah do? The Torah wants to teach us how to view such a situation. So what does the Torah do? It sets up a mitzvah. Listen to this way of understanding it. It sets up a mitzvah with this child, sends you on a direction where you believe there's no point, no return, accommodates your thinking and saying kill him before it's too late, and sets it up that it's impossible to happen. Why does Torah say that? Do that? To teach us a lesson. Teach us a lesson that that's an error to think such a thing. The Torah says, I will set you up in a situation and I will never allow it to happen. Because I need you to understand that there is no such a thing of a person at a point of no return. That doesn't exist.
That's what you keep teaching us about.
Exactly. Exactly. Because a person could have reached rock bottom, but there's always a place for tshuva. It's amazing that we read this in Chodesh Elul, by the way. Always read the month of Elul, this parasha. Right? That's what it means when the Gemara says, so why is it written? It's written to get reward, to learn and to get reward. Doesn't mean that we need another piece of Torah, we need an extra curriculum activity over here. It means it's there, so we should study it. We should study it. It's there because, not to implement, it's there to study how it cannot be implemented. Exactly the opposite. So if we study that, we get reward. What do we get reward? Because then we approach a person in a whole different way. We take the worst case scenario, the case of the child who's gone rock bottom, to the point where this is the child. If there's ever a child to apply the principle of point of no return, it will be him. And the Torah says, no, it's never going to happen. I'm never going to let you kill him. I'll set up the situation so complicated that it's impossible. And holy will never. That's the power of tshuva. The power of tshuva is because it's always a part of the person that's redeemable. There's never a person that's not redeemable. That's the message. So then he says the most creative and amazing thing. He says, so what's the next opinion in the Gemara? He says, no, it's completely misunderstood. He says, Rabbi Yonason is not coming to disagree with the first view. He's coming to agree with it. He says, let me tell you how right you are. He says, I saw a Ben Sori Ramayr. You have to be open for this. It's a completely different way of understanding the Gemara. He says, I saw Ben Sori Ramayr. I saw such a child. I saw such a child that everyone thought had hit rock bottom and there was a point of no return. And it didn't happen. In other words, they didn't kill him because halachically and statistically it's impossible to set it up that it should happen, they should be killed. And you know what happened to this child? He did tshuva. He went on to become a tzaddik. He died and I visited his kaver. And that's what he means, I visited his grave, like you visit a grave of a tzaddik. The expression of a yashafti al kivroi, I sat on his grave, is not an expression, I went to sit on his grave because I needed rest from a long trip. Sitting on a grave comes the expression of visiting, engaging in a grave of someone righteous because of the power, the kedusha that's there in the grave. He says, that's the pshat of Rabbi Yonason. He's not arguing, he's confirming. He says, I saw Ben Sarimah, I saw a guy that was finished, apparently. And of course it didn't kill him because it's impossible. And he went on and became this unbelievable tzaddik by Niyya Shafti al-Kibra and actually visited his grave. Just to prove the point. An amazing idea. So the two views are exactly the same. The point of it is, the lesson of it is, there is never a concept that a person has hit rock bottom of a point of no return. Clear? That's the power of tshuva. Now, let me go to the second issue. And this is a bit more complicated, so fasten your seatbelts. Okay, I hope everyone had a good breakfast today. A little bit technical, a little bit difficult, but it's very, very powerful. And it comes from a kind of an unexpected source in the parasha. And it's got to do with the concept of a get, which is this week's parasha. And I'm going to share with you inside first, so we understand it. Let me just find it 1 second. Where is it? Give me 1 second. Okay. Page 1058. Now, let me give you an introduction to what I'm about to share with you. You know that every mitzvah in the Torah, and we said this many, many times, happens on multi-layers. Okay? In other words, there's the basic implementation of the mitzvah, which is the halachic part of the mitzvah, and it's what the mitzvah means on a halachic practical level, and that's the way it's played out. And then every mitzvah plays out on a much deeper level and is applied on a whole spiritual and different dimension. Very often what happens with these things are, and why this is so powerful, is because sometimes we look at a mitzvah and there's aspects of the mitzvah that seem completely not understood. Right? And sometimes the reason for that is because the details are not understood because we're looking at the mitzvah only on its practical level. And sometimes on its practical level it plays out a certain way and it leaves aspects of the mitzvah unexplained. And that's fine, because it's unexplained on that level, because on that level it's not relevant, it doesn't matter anymore. But the reason that it leaves passage is unexplained is because when you take the mitzvah on a different level, suddenly some of those aspects of that mitzvah become clearer. Is that an understood concept? Because that's very important what we're about to understand. So in this week's parsha, we have the laws of marriage and the laws of divorce. But let's have a look at inside the thing. It's page 1058. Pasuk Beis. Sorry, Pasuk Aleph, I mean. First verse. Chapter 24, verse 1. Says the Torah, Ki yikach ish isha, if a man will take a woman, meaning marry a woman, uba'ala, and he will live with her, v'haya im lo yisim tzachein ba'enav, and then she does not find favor in eyes, in other words, the marriage breaks up, for whatever reason, could be many reasons, but one of the reasons mentioned here, ki motza erbas dover, he found something that he doesn't like, or could be vice versa, and there's different aspects which are not time to go into. Then what does he do? The marriage can be halachically terminated. How's it done? V'chassav lo sefer krisus, he needs to write for her what the Torah refers to as a sefer krisus, a document of termination, a document of cutting off. V'nosan v'yoda, and he should place it into her hand. Of course, these halachas are much more complicated than that, but that's just the basic idea. V'shilcha mibeisa, and then she leaves his house. V'yotza mibeisa, she goes, now the halacha continues, interesting thing. V'yotza mibeisa, she goes out of his house. V'holcha v'hoysol ish acher, and let's say she goes now and marries a second man. Okay, so let's say now going into another mitzvah. So, man and woman marry, they're divorced, and the woman now marries another man. And let's say, says the Torah, v'holcha v'hoysol ish acher, so goes and marries another man. Usneya ish acher, and the second man also doesn't like her, and the marriage breaks up. V'kosel la sefer krisus, and gives her a document of termination. Nasa Miyada gives it into hand. The Shilcha Mibesa and sent her out from his home. Or the scenario is, Giyomus Isha Acha, the second husband dies, for example, Shilakocha Al Isha. Whatever reason, the second marriage came to an end. The halacha is, interesting halacha, Lo Yuchal Baila Harishan Ashil Shulcha Loshuv Lakachta, the first husband is prohibited then from taking her back. Liyas Lada Isha, otherwise a person. Is in halacha, a person is allowed to marry a woman, or a man and woman allowed to marry after they've divorced, but not if in the meantime the woman has gotten married to someone else. Right? Acharei ha-shutumah, because she now lives with someone else. Ki toiv v'hinif na-Hashem, it's considered as something that's not favorable in the eyes of Hashem. V'le sachti yis'oritz, to not bring transgression to the land. Asher Hashem l'recha meisul l'cha na'achal. Clear? So there's a couple of things. Now, what's interesting from this is, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, this parsha is seems predominantly about the divorce, but actually it's also a parasha about marriage. We learn the halachas of marriage from this parasha as well, which I'm going to show you in a second. So there's a couple of things we need to understand, just so we understand where this is all going. The Torah makes reference to a get, to a, and by the way, it's called a get. The get is not a Torah term. In fact, the word get is an Aramaic term for documents, which could be any document actually, but we only refer to the divorce document because the halacha is, and I'll soon show you why, that in a divorce document, in a get, there's 12 lines, and the gematria of the word get is 12. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Now, in the Torah, this document is referred to by two things. It's two words called Sefer Krisus. Sefer means a book normally, a document. Krisus of cutting off. Right? So we learn, the Gemara learns that the reason that it's called Sefer Krisus is because halachically it only takes effect if it's a complete cutting off document. In other words, it cannot be any strings attached. Right? Marriage is something which halachically is achieved through certain ways, kiddushin, it's a halachic binding. The way that's terminated is for the husband to give the wife a get, and that completely terminates and cuts off the husband from the wife, and it breaks up the marriage halachically, and there's nothing left that's connected then between the husband and the wife. Right? If a get, and there's all kinds of halachas, I learned the Gemara, if a person writes a get, and in the get there's some sort of condition which implies that the document is not a completely terminating document, that document is not kosher as a divorce document. Okay?
So why? Get isn't a Hebrew word. What's the Hebrew?
It's an Aramaic.
It's an Aramaic word
for documents.
Oh,
document. Yeah. In Gemara, in the real halachic term would be shtar gerushin. It would be a document of divorce. Mm-hmm. But it's called a get because it's got 12 lines. That's why we call it a get. Okay. So that's the concept of a get, and a get obviously is a divide. That's what it is. It's a dividing document. Okay. So the Rebbe in his sicha in that particular essay raises a number of interesting questions. And again, these are philosophical questions, not halachic questions, but it's philosophical questions. And then it's used; these questions are used then to take this whole concept on a whole other level of discussion. He asks the following question like this: first of all, if we call that document a dividing document, then how come we find that in this document that actually we find very unifying aspects to it? What do I mean? First of all, the fact that it's called a Sefer. The Torah makes it a Sefer. Why? Because the Gemara learns that the reason it's called a Sefer is because it needs to be written like a Sefer Torah. Just like a Sefer Torah is written in a certain way, a certain font, and it's lined in a certain way, etc., etc., that document also has to be written in a certain way. Okay? Now, obviously, there's nothing to be further between a divorce document and a Torah. The whole concept of Torah is unity. A Torah didn't last a shalom ba'olam. Torah was given to make peace in the world, was bringing to unify people, right? This is more of a dividing document. More so even, actually, the truth is it has even a unifying aspect which is even greater than the Torah. One of the halachas of the get is that it's got written on one document. If a divorce document was written on two different pieces of paper, even if they were sewn together, it's not a kosher document. Now, on a halachic level, that's very understood because it's got to be clear and it's got to be absolutely foolproof and so on and so forth. But philosophically, we need to understand how can we find that concept of oneness in this document? So much so that it's a completely dividing document. It has to be one that cannot attach people together. It's got to be completely cutting off. And yet, at the same time, we have this idea that it's got to be one book. It's a sefer, right? Another interesting thing is, I said that the minhag is, the custom is, that a get has 12 lines. Why has it got 12 lines? So on the one hand, it also comes from a dividing concept, but yet it's in that dividing concept, there's a unifying concept. Why has it got 12 lines? Because, you know, in a Sefer Torah, because it's written like a Sefer Torah, you know, Sefer Torah has five books, right? There's five books of the Chumash. Within those five books, the first four are separate from the fifth. The first four, like the first four that Hashem said himself. Sefer Dvarim is more what Moshe Rabbeinu said, right? So Bereshis Bamidbar, Bereshis Shmois Vayikra, and Bamidbar are four books, and the way they're written in the Torah starts with Bereshis. Between each sefer, between each book of the Torah, there has to be a gap. So there's three gaps in these four books, correct? How big does the gap has to be? No, four lines. So 4 times 3 is 12, right? 4 times 3 is 12. Okay. Because there's 12 lines that separate between the books, therefore a get has to be 12 lines. But if you think about it, it's a bizarre concept. Because it... what's it going to do with it? Right? What's the connection? Here we're talking about the lines that separate between the Torah. The lines that separate between the Torah are not dividing lines. They're just demarcations to know which way one book ends, one book beginning. It's on the concept. There, the inherent idea in those lines are not division. Part of the Torah. Those gaps are part of the Torah. It's part of the Sefer Torah. The Torah is a unifying force, not a dividing force. Okay. Second question. The third problem is a fascinating thing. When two people marry, the Torah gives three ways that people can get married. We only use one way today, but there are three halachic mechanisms to affect the concept of kiddushin. When two people get married, the legal marriage, okay, I'm not going to go into the whole concept now, but there's two parts of every marriage. I don't know if you know this. Kiddushin and Nisuin, which is like the two brachas we make under the chuppah, the two sets of brachas, right? But kiddushin is the legal aspect of marriage when husband and wife become legally married, and that's when the husband sort of acquires the marriageability of the woman, so to speak, right? And in the Torah, we learn there's three ways it can happen. One is through the husband giving the wife something of monetary value, okay? That's what we do today. That's the ring. When the husband gives the wife the ring, that affects the marriage. They are now legally married. They are now a legally married woman. The other one is a shtar, a document, which we don't use today. We have a ksuba, but that's not the marriage document. That's just a side document. But a ksuba, a shtar is, he would, instead of giving her monetary value, they would do it by document. In other words, he would write a document saying, instead of giving her the ring and saying, Hare at mekudeshesh, he would write that in a document and give her the document in front of two witnesses. That would also affect the marriage. Or intimacy. In other words, intimacy obviously is part of marriage, but intimacy could also affect the legal part of marriage, where he would seclude himself with her in a room in front of two witnesses, outside the room of course, and live with her intimately, and that would then create the marriage if it was done for the sake of marriage, right? Those are the three, those are the three ways. How do we, sorry?
Can you repeat this? The intimacy in the sake of marriage, the ring and...
The money, a document and intimacy. Yeah, those are the three.
And that should be all completed.
No, no, those are the three ways that you can affect the marriage. Okay. Now, we don't do those three ways today. We only use the one way. We only use the ring. We only use the monetary way, right? And by the way, it could be any monetary thing. There's a whole lot. We use the ring. It's Kabbalistic. Whatever. But that's the method we use today. That under the chuppah, the husband gives the wife the ring in front of the witnesses. And he says, "Arayat Megadesh," and that we affect the marriage. Okay. Where do we know these three things from? Where do we know the three methods of marriage from? From the paragraph of divorce. It's a funny source for marriage, isn't it? Right? And let me show you how. Ki yikach ish, isha. Go back to Paskalev. If a man will take a woman. The word yikach is almost an expression of... I don't mean it this way, of course, but this is what the expression is. It's an expression of purchasing almost. It's a transactionary language. Okay? And in fact, we learn it through via a mechanism called the Gezeirah Shavah. Gezeirah Shavah is, where do we find this word yikach elsewhere in the Torah? When Avraham Avinu brought the field from Ephraim to Beri Sarah. And where it links it, that's the whole one of the methods of Torah Shabbat Peh. We have something called the Gezeirah Shavah. We have the same, a similar phraseology in two places. So we link them. And just like there, the kicha, the purchasing, so to speak, the acquisition happened through money, so this can happen through money as well. So it's the expression of kicha, ki yikach, the man takes a woman, that teaches us that one of the ways of marriage can be done like a transactionary process, and it's done through something of monetary value. That's source number one. Then the Torah says, yikach ish isha uba Allah, if he will take her and live with her intimately. That's what we learn, that intimacy creates a marriage. Right? How do we know a document? So listen, this is even more bizarre. So it says like this. In Pasuk Beis, it says, v'yotza mi beisoi, she went out of his house through divorce. And she went and married another woman. Says the Gemara, because of that, there are many halachas. In the one pasuk we talk about her going out, being divorced, and then remarrying. So we learn that there's lots of halachas which link the laws of divorce and laws of marriage. One of them being that just like divorce is through a document, marriage can also take place through a document. And that's how we learn the third thing. So all three methods of marriage are learned from the parsha of divorce. And the Rebbe says, isn't that a bizarre sort of thing? Like, they're completely two opposite things. The one is to bring two people together to become one. The other one is completely divisive, meaning to divide them. And there can be a good reason for that. But the fact is, that's what it is. It's a process of cutting the two pieces apart. So how come that the laws of marriage should be learned from the laws of divorce? Then he raises, I'm going to just share this with you for sake of completion, but he raises another very interesting issue. There is in Gemara, you know, we have tractates, mesechtas, that deal with different halachas. There's one mesechta called Mesechta Gittin. It's long, it's over 80 pages long, and it deals with all the very, very complex laws of divorce and how it all works, right? Now you'd imagine if a mesechta like that would start, it should start with the laws of divorce and then go into specific details later. We'll start with general halachas and go into specific. We'll talk about the regular or the things that are always applied and then talk about exceptional cases and weird cases, etc. But that's not the case. If you have a look at your handout, the very first Mishnah in the Tractate of Gittin starts with the following halacha. Hamevi get mi medina sayam. It talks about a case. I'll tell you the context. The case is the wife is in Israel, the Eretz Israel, right? And the husband is overseas, and overseas in Gemara is called Medina Sayon. Medina Sayon means the country of the sea. Another way of saying overseas. He's in a country which is over the ocean, right? And he wants to divorce his wife, so we have a mechanism in Halacha, which is still used sometimes today, where a husband can divorce his wife through a shliach. He gives the get through a messenger, the messenger brings it to the wife. So the halacha is, if someone is a shliach, someone is a messenger to bring a get, and it says Mishnah, Hamevi get mi medina sayam, he brings the get from overseas. Right? So there's a whole issue there. I'm not going to go into the whole issue now. The issue is we need to be able to verify the get. How come? What happens if he gives the get to the wife and then she's divorced, she goes and gets married, and then the husband rocks up one day and says, I never wrote this get. So it's got to be verified somehow. So we need, so the Mishnah continues, we need Sarach Shayomer, that we need that the Shliach should say and testify, this get I saw it being written, it was written before me, it was signed before me, and it's an authentic get. So Rebbe says, raises the question, it's a very strange thing here. Why would we take the whole Masechta? I mean, there's a very rare case, right? Of husband and wife being in two different countries. I mean, not today so much, but in those days for sure, right? Being in two different countries, and it's a shliach, and that's how it was written, and the shliach is bringing it from overseas, and that's the first Mishnah. We don't even know how maybe get. He's bringing a get. What is a get? How's it written? What does it mean? How does it affect? How are you supposed to give it? All those halachas, which are the core crux of the laws of getting, the Mishnah doesn't start with. What does it start with? It starts with some detail of someone bringing a get from the husband who happens to be overseas. That's what we need to understand. Okay. So as I said before, all these are very interesting questions, and they are questions that obviously don't affect the get, how it's understood on a halachic level. But the reason these questions are asked, and the reason this question needs to be understood or only explained, is if we take this mitzvah now on a completely different level, and we take it rather than talking about a relationship between husband and wife, we're talking about the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, which is also a relationship of husband and wife. So, well, let me show you first a fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says, it's on your handouts. The Gemara says like this. Because we know that when the Yidden, let me give you the background, when the Yidden stood at Har Sinai, by Matan Torah, when Hashem gave us the Torah, we know that was like a marriage, correct? In fact, it says, Yom Chasu Nosa Izu Matan Torah. Shlomo HaMelech in Shir HaShirim refers to the day of Hashem's wedding, as the day of Matan Torah. That's the day he married the Jewish people. He was the chassan, we are the kala, and there's a marriage, a relationship that exists between God and the Jewish people. When Hashem sent us into Golus, when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, so there's references in Gemara elsewhere where it almost appears that like when we mess up our relationship with Hashem, it's almost compared to a divorce. Right? And there's many different places in the Gemara where we find that, and it's understood different places in different ways. So one fascinating Gemara is Gemara in Yuma. It's the last piece on your handout. Omar Rabbi Yochanan talks, it's a Gemara which talks about the greatness of tshuva. Omar Rabbi Yochanan says, Gedoyla tshuva. Tshuva is such a great concept. Shadoyche loisa se shuva Torah. Tshuva is so powerful that it's able to push aside one of the prohibitions of the Torah. It overrides one of the prohibitions of the Torah. What does that mean? What the Gemara means is like this. We just learned that if two people are married and they get divorced, then the woman goes and lives with another man, then she can't come back to her first husband, correct? Says the Gemara, what happens with tshuva? Tshuva is, the Yid has a relationship with Hashem, then a Yid messes up. So he goes astray. So there's a separation between God and the Jewish and the Jew. And what does the Jew do? He becomes unfaithful. He goes and he runs off and he serves a different God. Or he does something which he likes, serving a different God. Right? Then there's a problem. He wants to do tshuva. What does tshuva mean? Tshuva, the word tshuva means return. So tshuva means the Jew says, now I'm upset. I don't want to live with a foreign God anymore. I want to come back to God. I want to come back to Hashem. I want to recreate the relationship between me and Hashem. And what does tshuva do? We know that tshuva means Hashem forgives us and he takes us back. But he takes us back, it's in violation of this mitzvah. The halacha says that if the wife left and she lived with another man, she cannot return to her husband. Says the Gemara, tshuva is so great that it overrides a prohibition in the Torah. So the Rebbe on this asks two questions. And then takes it to the whole concept. He asks two questions. Question number one is, how can we contemplate the concept of a divorce between us and Hashem? One of the halachas of a get is that the piece of paper that the husband has, which he gives to the wife to divorce her, belongs to him, but then it must leave his rishus, it must leave his property. It cannot be in his possession. Right? In other words, it must reach the woman, it must reach the wife, so much so that she has taken it in her hands and it's completely cut off from the husband. No longer belongs to him. It's not in his possession, not in his hands, it's not in his house. It's in nothing that belongs to him. Right? He's now out of the picture. Problem with God is it's very hard to say that, because everywhere, Hashem is everywhere. Hashem Alech Alaretz Kvoda, right? Hashem's presence is everywhere. So if we're gonna compare it, let's test it all the way. If we're gonna compare it, how can we say there's a concept of the Jewish person leaving Hashem, or Hashem leaving, so to speak, the marriage? What does that mean? Like, what does that? How does that work? How does the get work between us and Hashem? If He can't really give us a get that will leave Him, and He can't sort of take Himself out of the picture. Number one. Number two, if it is true, it's a very beautiful thing to say that tshuva is so great that it overrides a mitzvah. Remember I told you last week, however, that Hashem is bound by His mitzvahs. So what do you mean it overrides a mitzvah? It can't override a mitzvah. If it's a mitzvah, it's a mitzvah. If it's a prohibition for the wife to return to the husband after having a relationship with another man, so then it doesn't work. So how can tshuva actually work then? What is tshuva? What is tshuva? What's the power of tshuva that I can override a mitzvah? What mitzvahs all of a sudden can be overridden? How can we override a mitzvah? It's a nice concept. It's like saying, you know, tshuva is so great. It's like, sound nice. What does it actually mean? How can you override a mitzvah? Okay. So he explains the following. The Gemara in Tainis says, and this is where, of course, when we talk about the laws of divorce on a spiritual level, it's going to be totally different to how it is on a superficial level. When two people interact, they can only interact on a superficial level, or they interact what you see. When they don't interact, they don't interact. With Hashem and us, however, the relationship exists on two levels, different to how it is in this physical world. We have a revealed relationship between us and Hashem, a functional relationship. We keep the mitzvahs, we keep the Torah, we got married in Matan Torah, and that's our relationship. The Gemara in Taini says that in Golus, when the Yidden go into Golus, so the Gemara uses this expression, the relationship between God and the Jewish people is like a woman whose husband went limedinas hayam, same expression as the beginning of Gittin. It's like a wife whose husband left and he went overseas. So too in Golus, we don't have revealed godliness. When there was a Beis Hamikdash and we had a functional relationship with Hashem, so the relationship was on a deep level. The spiritual consciousness was very there, it was very emphasized. We felt godliness, we felt the relationship with Hashem. Hashem then allowed the Beis Hamikdash to be destroyed, and he went. He went like the Zohar says. The Zohar says that Kutshabrichu Salik Le'ela Le'ela. It's like Hashem has departed into the highest heavens. Highest heavens. In other words, he's no longer here. He's no longer here in a revealed way. Right? Which is why it's possible for him to give us a get. Because he, in a revealed way, he can take himself out of the picture. And he has taken himself out of the picture. He's not relating to us in a revealed way like he used to. Now it's interesting that the term that's used is Medinas Hayam for overseas, Medinas Hayam. Because we also know, and this is what he explains within the Sikha, we also know that the way Hashem responds to us is the way we act to Him. And this is why the first Mishnah, Masech Begittim, talks about someone who's bringing a get from Medinas Hayam, from overseas. Because it explains how the spiritual get works. It explains that number one, Hashem is overseas, so to speak. He's, in a revealed way, He's out of the picture. It also explains why He did that. Why did it is because we act like Medina Sayyam. What does Medina Sayyam mean? What does the Mishnah mean when it talks about Medina Sayyam? Medina Sayyam is a reference to a sea that separates Eretz Yisrael from another country. Right? What does it mean when we like that? When we are Medina Sayyam, it means that we are in a situation, every Yid has an Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, you know why Eretz Yisrael is called Eretz Yisrael? Because Eretz comes from the word Ratzon, to want, to desire, to serve Hashem. Just like we have an Eretz Yisrael in space, we have an Eretz Yisrael in time. Not in time, in our neshama, we have in time also. We have an Eretz Yisrael in our neshama. And neshama means we've got deep down a Ratzon, a deep will to serve Hashem, a connection to Hashem, that is always there. What happens to us, however, sometimes is we create a barrier between us and our will to serve Hashem. What's that barrier? The barrier is the turbulence of the sea. We get involved in all the stuff that's going on in our lives, which is compared to the waves of the sea, and it creates a separation between us and the will to serve Hashem, between us and our own Eretz Yisrael. When we do that, and we disconnect ourselves from the process of serving Hashem properly, Hashem responds in kind, and He takes off. He takes off to Medina Siyam. He takes off to overseas. He takes off to space, so to speak, where He appears to be distant from us and far from us. And that's the source of the concept of the get between Hashem and us. That's why it's the first Mishnah, Masechta Gittin, because it explains the get between Hashem and the Jewish people. However, when it comes to our relationship with Hashem, that happens on two levels. And this is where the concept of tshuva comes in. Because while it is true that there is a concept of separation, and there is a concept of a get, right, between us and Hashem, however, there's a whole nother level of our relationship between us and Hashem, where there is no get, because there cannot be a get. Why? There is a level of relationship which is hidden, that exists between us and Hashem, where the relationship is unmovable. There is a level that very, very deep down, you know that in Aseres Yemei Tshuva, in the 10 days of Tshuva, there's a Tehillim we recite every day, 130, called Shir HaMalas Mima'amakim Karasicha Hashem. We say, I call out to the depths, Hashem. Right? I call to you from the depths. And the first we explain, what does it mean I call to you from the depths? And depths there is in the plural. It doesn't say I call to you from the depth of my soul. The depths, with an S, right? So it explains in Kabbalistic explanation, it says, because there's two depths. There's the depth of a Jew and the depth of Hashem. In other words, there is a system where the relation between us and Hashem is on the functional level. On the functional level, we relate to Hashem, he relates to us. We do mitzvahs, he responds, he gives us what we need, whatever the case is. But then there's a time where that relationship gets messed up. It's damaged to the point where there's a divorce. So what happens then? We have tshuva. What does tshuva do? Tshuva is not the pshat that tshuva overrides a mitzvah. Tshuva takes the relationship between us and Hashem to a level which is coming from the very depths of the Jew, reaching and accessing the very depth of Hashem. There's a level where us and Hashem relate, which is not negotiable. It's unmovable. Where it cannot be different. Where the deep down, the level, it's like the Ben Sori Remoire. The Ben Sori Remoire, I said before, the rebellious son, he can reach rock bottom, but he can only reach rock bottom at a functional level. He can never reach a point of no return, because there's always that pinta layit, so to speak, there's always that depth of the neshama that is always there, where the will of the yid is to do what Hashem wants, even if he doesn't know, he's not conscious of it, but it's always there. The Eretz Yisrael of the Jew is always there, and the rotzen that Hashem has to connect to us is always there. So when we say that Hashem took himself up overseas, and Dina Sayama, the Zohar says, he goes la'ela, la'ela, he goes to the upper heavens and he's no longer here, that's true on a functional level, that's true on a revealed level, but it's not true on a deeper level. Follow? In other words, when the Gemara says that tshuva is so great that it overrides the negative commandment, it doesn't mean it overrides the negative commandment. It means that tshuva is so powerful that it can take the relationship down to the depths of the relationship to reveal that in fact the relationship still exists, and in fact the halacha no longer applies, because in fact the woman didn't go live with another man, because there's a level of the relationship where there's no unfaithfulness. There's a level of relationship where the Yid and God are one thing and always one thing, no matter what happens. Just not on a functional level, but at a deeper level. At a deeper level, our depths and Hashem's depths are connected and locked in forever and eternally, and it can never be damaged. Okay? Now, how do you reach that level? How do you access that depth? And that's what it means in overrides the loss. It means it reveals the depth of the relationship where the negative commandment doesn't apply anymore. Because you've revealed the relationship where there is no problem halachically anymore. How does it happen? So the way it happens is a concept that I've told you many times during the month of Elul and Tishrei, but it relates to this as well. How does it actually happen? How do we actually reveal that very powerful, irrational, super rational relationship that we have with Hashem that is eternal and can never be corrupted or damaged? How do we bring it out? So here's the depth. This is what he explains, most beautiful idea. Here's the depth, that unity and the laws of marriage are actually learned from the get. We said this is a very strange thing. Why do you learn the laws of marriage from the get? So obviously it only makes sense because we're talking about now the get on a higher level, on a deeper level, on a spiritual level. The reason it's like this is like this. Sometimes the depth of the relationship between us and Hashem is revealed specifically when the operational, functional relationship has been messed up. It's like I've told you many times about a parent and a child. When a parent-child's relationship has been corrupted because the child's not behaving properly, whatever the case is, right? The only way to repair that is to bring the relationship deeper. For the parent to remind themselves of the unconditional love they have for the child, the love they had on the very first day when they were born. Right? When the love wasn't built based on any functionality, it was just based on because it's my child. Right? What happens when a child grows up, we relate to the child on an operational level? We get happy when the child behaves, we do the homework and they succeed, etc., etc. We get upset when they don't succeed, right? So what happens is, when the child becomes operational, when the child becomes functional, the depth of the relationship, the very foundational relationship, goes into the background. It's there, but it's in the background. What is apparent and what is being obvious and what is being worked on most of the time is the operational relationship. In fact, sometimes we even forget about the in-depth, unconditional relationship that we have with our child. When does it come out again? It comes out again when the operational relationship gets messed up. And there's a distance. And the distance causes separation between the parent and child. And the only way for it to come back is for everyone to remember, hold on a second, there's a relationship on a deeper level. And that's when you access the power of the relationship that's on a deeper level. Which is why the Gemara says that a Baal Tshuva is greater than a Tzaddik. Because a Tzaddik is a perfect human being. A Tzaddik is one that serves Hashem the whole time. But not necessarily is there a depth and a passion of the relationship. Because it's operational, it's fantastic. It's just working. The Baal Tshuva is someone who is far from Hashem. It's like a child that is yearning for the father, a child that is distant from the father. And suddenly realize how far he is and yearns to be connected to the father and yearns with a very in-depth yearning that comes from the very, very depth of the relationship between parent and child, that suddenly it accesses such a deep yearning to connect to the father that cannot be accessed unless there was a distance. The distance creates the yearning. The distance reveals the depth of the relationship. Now, there's not a recommendation to do anything wrong. It's not a recommendation to become sinful, God forbid, right? But it does highlight the concept of tshuva. Tshuva is about reflection, where we reflect on the year gone by and we highlight the areas of distance. That's what tshuva is. Tshuva is to highlight those weaknesses. One of the weaknesses? The weaknesses are the areas in our life where we have become distant from Hashem. And it's specifically the distance that activates that burning desire to reconnect. And activates such a desire and such a level of relationship that is impossible to activate unless there's distance. The distance actually facilitates the depth of the relationship that wasn't there before, that wasn't revealed before, I should say. Follow this? Because while everything's working well, you don't need that in-depth relationship. While everything's working well, so the relationship is functional. And that's the way it works, operates like that. So therefore, on the deeper level of this part of the parasha, it reveals the real credible depth of tshuva. Tshuva is not just about saying, sorry, something I did wrong, and I'm not going to do it again. Tshuva, the word tshuva means to return. To return means to reconnect to Hashem on an incredible deeper level. This is in everyone's life, and the Rebbe explains it also with regard to Golus. It's an amazing thing. When the Yidden were in the Beis HaMikdash with Hashem, the relationship was very functional. When there's no Beis HaMikdash and the Yidden are in Golus, so in a revealed way, the relationship is very weak. And yet, there's some depth of the relationship that exists between the Yidden and Hashem in Golus, specifically in Golus, that wasn't there. The conviction, the Mesiras Nefesh, the determination to keep Hashem's mitzvahs, notwithstanding that we don't feel, we don't understand, we're not close. Where does that come from? Where does it come from that a Jew should show up Yom Kippur to shul and he hasn't got any connection the whole year round? Where does that come from? It's not just cultural. It comes from a certain depth that can only be highlighted when a person is distant. Yeah.
Is it related to the concept of one bad things happen to good people? In other words, great people that get more challenges because it's the same kind of fun.
Yeah, I think it's related. I'm not sure exactly the same idea, but I mean that has many different angles to it. But yeah. And sometimes our challenges reveal greater things and that person is ready for it. And that yeah. But that's what tshuva is. And that's the spiritual meaning of why we learn the laws of marriage and we have that Torah halachas that finds its way into a get, which is about all about the relationship between us and Hashem, because there's that spiritual, talking about now on a spiritual level, that spiritual divorce that brings a deeper marriage between Hashem and the Jewish people. It's specifically the distance that allows us to reveal and to reactivate that very deep relationship we have with Hashem, to reveal that at a deep level we're always one with Him. And once we reveal that, then we can rebuild on that. Then we can start in the mitzvahs again, and we can return home, and we can start rebuilding our functional relationship with him once we've gone all the way back to the very depth of the relationship. And that's, again, it doesn't answer the questions on a revealed level. On a revealed level, these things remain unexplained, but they don't have to be explained. Because the mitzvah operates on different levels, that's why these details of this mitzvah are there, because they're explained on a deeper level. And that's how that demonstrates the whole power of children. Okay?